Hello, everybody. I'm an alcoholic. My name is Stephen Todd. Member of the Serenity Improvement Group in Kingsport. Our motto or theme there at Serenity Improvement Group is Welcome Home. And that's what I felt like when I walked in the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous for the first time. I'd like to thank the committee for inviting me. It's a real honor. It's a privilege to be able to share my experience, strength, and hope in front of this esteemed body. Introduce myself a little different than most people do in AA. I tell you I'm an alcoholic before I tell you my name. Most of you all can understand why, because the fact that I'm an alcoholic is something I can never change. But you know and I know I can go to the courthouse and change my name very easily. So the fact that I am an alcoholic really controls who I am and what I am. I learned in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous there's nothing bad going on in my life, a drink won't make worse, and conversely there's nothing good going on, a drink won't totally destroy. That's what it means to be an alcoholic. I came into this program kind of honestly, or dishonestly. And nobody in this room has heard my story before. So I'm at liberty just to tell a hell of a tale. I don't have any boundaries whatsoever. Jim asked me not to show him up, and I said, well, you know, I can tell a big, large tale tonight, and everybody just think it's great, but most people know you, and you got some boundaries you got to operate within. I don't have those boundaries tonight. The only boundary I have is my relationship with God. And that determines how I exist and how I walk in this face of this earth. Little something that some of you all may have heard before. Whiskey bottles and brand new cars. Oak tree, you're in my way. There's too much coke and too much smoke. Look what's going on inside you. Angel of darkness is upon you. Stuck a needle in your arm. So take another toke, have a blow for your nose. One more drink fool will drown you. Now they call you Prince Charming. Can't speak a word when you're full of lewds. Say you'll all be all right come tomorrow, but tomorrow might not be here for you. Ooh, that smell. Can't you smell that smell? Ooh, that smell. The smell of death surrounds you. Anybody ever heard that song before? Yeah. I listened to that song out of my mind and thought it was a wonderful song. That tells you how sick I was. The book tells me to tell you in a general way what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like now. I'm a third generation attorney in my hometown in Kingsport. I grew up the oldest of three children in my family. My parents drank alcohol. There was a liquor cabinet. And I would like to tell you that I grew up with a silver jigger in my mouth. I never wanted for anything as a child materialistically. The liquor cabinet wasn't locked. I saw my parents and their friends drink alcohol. Never saw any of the ill effects of alcohol that so many people see growing up. I saw alcohol as something that adults did when they were having fun. In my family, you were expected to excel in school. I excelled in school. There was a premium to be number one. I didn't have to do chores. All I had to do was make straight A's. My parents were of that generation that there was not a lot of a physical affection between the two of them. They didn't talk about feelings. The most I ever saw was my father give my mother a kiss on the forehead. I knew they loved each other, and I knew they loved us, but they showed love with material possessions. So I did well in school. About the time I got in junior high school, I started, by the time I hit puberty, I guess, I started noticing big-breasted women. And they weren't real interested in me. They seemed to be more interested in the jocks, are the guys who didn't make the best grades, and are the people who had motorcycles. And I couldn't understand that. And I had the money my grandparents had given me, and I wanted a motorcycle, something fierce. And my parents wouldn't allow me to get a motorcycle, and that pissed me off. And I couldn't understand what the purpose was of being a straight-A student, excelling in school, when I would be with my parents or with their friends, and in particular when my uncle and his wife would come visit from Louisville, Kentucky. He had been, was an attorney also and was editor of the Harvard Law Review, and they would be with my parents, and I'd be there, and I'd always been able to share my thoughts and opinions with whoever my parents' friends were, but when my uncle was in town, I wasn't allowed to share mine. I was kind of cast aside, and that upset me. So I determined that maybe these straight A's are not all that important. Maybe I can have a better time if I just cruise by. I don't remember the first drink of alcohol I ever had, but I remember the very first time I got drunk. I was 14 years old. It was in the springtime, and an older friend of mine, whose father was a surgeon, was home from prep school and went to Lawrence in Lawrenceville, New Jersey. And two of us with Michael got together and went out to his parents' farmhouse. And we went across the state line into Virginia to a cinder block shed over there that had red paint handwritten on it, fireworks. That was a bootlegger. And the three of us bought 5 pints of Era vodka. I know today it wasn't Era vodka, because when you go into a liquor store, you don't find a lot of glue on the seal. So we went out to this farm, and I drank a pint mixed with knee-high orange soda, and it was about dusk, and I was flying high, and this fellow Terry that was with us handed me a full bottle. He had a full bottle in his hand and said, "I'll race you." And I beat him. That's the last thing I remember until I came to the next morning, buck naked, feeling worse than I'd ever felt in my life, freezing to death, wrapped up in a throw rug on a cold hardwood floor of this first story of this two-story farmhouse. I found my white tennis shoes, white socks, white jeans, and white t-shirt out on the front porch covered with blood and puke. I didn't know what had happened. The house was still winterized. I went into the laundry room where the washing machine was. Couldn't, no water. But I got a box of Ivory soap suds with a really pretty lady on it that I learned later on was Marilyn Chambers. And she must have thought I was a sight, because I walked naked through wet knee-high grass, holding my head down to a pond about 100 yards away, trying to wash my clothes to get rid of that smell. And I couldn't do it. I couldn't get rid of that smell. I can still smell that puke and vodka or puke and moonshine today. And I came back in, and I found my friends. They were sleeping in bedrooms upstairs, and my friend Michael was extremely upset with me. Told me that I'd gotten sick in his car, back of his Volkswagen Bug, and I said, "No, I didn't go anywhere." And he said, "Yes, you did. As soon as you got through drinking that last pint, we left and we went to Johnson City and Bristol and cruised the drive-ins, and you were the life of the party, and you hadn't gotten sick until 2 o'clock in the morning when we came back down the driveway to the farmhouse." And I said, "That didn't happen." And I went to the car, and somebody got sick in the back seat of the car, so that was pretty conclusive evidence I had been in that car. I did not know at that time that was a blackout. That was my first blackout, and to my knowledge, that was the longest blackout I've had yet. And that word "yet" is very important in my recovery. Now, I liked what alcohol had done for me. I found out a little later in the day that my friend Terry had water in his bottle. Nice guy. He died 15, 20 years ago from a heroin overdose. He was one of us. I liked what alcohol had done, but I swore off vodka. And that's a reoccurring theme in my story, is swearing off vodka. I knew that I wanted to be a man, and I knew that a man ought to be able to hold his liquor without getting sick, so I set out to learn how to drink like a man. And on Fridays and Saturday nights in junior high school, I would drink and get sick and drink and get sick and drink and get sick to where I got to where I could drink without getting sick. And I was damn proud of myself. I went off to a private high school outside of Philadelphia in the late 60s and got exposed to other substances. And I did those predominantly for a period of time, because you can do those and you don't have to worry about getting sick. And besides, when you do those, you don't have to show an ID to the guy you buy those from. You know, but But if you go to the store to buy some booze, you got to show an ID. And then when I got into college, I went to Washington Lee University undergraduate school, a great school for an alcoholic, a budding alcoholic. If you paid your class dues, they had pure grain alcohol parties once a semester. And I remember seeing people passed out with arms hanging over branches and drinking purple Jesus out of the trash can at the bottom, and that was the life. And I started mixing alcohol and other substances together. And my mantra at the time, and I would have told you that when I died, I wanted on my tombstone, it was, is, and forever will be so nice. And as long as I could medicate to the right level, it was so nice. And I stayed that way for a while, and I ended up having to drop out of school because I wasn't going to school all that much, and came back and worked in my hometown for this company, doing a reevaluation of property where I went around and measured houses and drew little diagrams and all this stuff. And it was a great company to work for because once a month they would tell you on Friday afternoon to knock off at 2 o'clock and come to the office, and they'd give you all the beer you could drink. And they wanted to make me a company man, and I decided that's not what I wanted because my father and I had a discussion one time. He said, you don't want to go to work for somebody where you can walk in one day and say, we don't need you anymore, Stephen. It's time for you to go home. So I decided I would go back to school and finally knuckle down and become an attorney, you know, the family profession. So I went, three of us got a place over in Johnson City, Tennessee, and I enrolled at East Tennessee State. I had a wonderful 179 after 2.5 years at W&L. I actually spent too much time at Hollins, Randolph, Macon, and Sweetbriar running the roads, all girls' schools. So I went over there for the first quarter, and there were three of us living together. And we'd get up in the morning, and we'd twist one, and we'd drink one, and we'd twist another one and get another can of Busch beer. And we would get in the car ready to go to school, and we'd drive down to the bottom of the rock driveway. And we look at Buffalo Mountain, and we look back towards the campus, and we look at Buffalo Mountain, and we look back towards the campus and go, no, and we go to Buffalo Mountain and play for the day. That was the routine. And I don't know about schools, other places, but they have something called Drop Ad Day, which is a derelict student's magic time. You can, on Drop Ad Day, you can go there and drop all your classes, and you don't even show you were ever registered for them. And, you know, I knew I had that 179, and I knew I was in trouble. And so I decided to, we all three decided to drop out of school and join the Navy. So we dropped out of school, went to the Navy recruiter's office, took the test, and I was qualified for nuclear power. Yes, nuclear power. My friends wanted to be corpsmen. And I told you I grew up enjoying material things. And I should have known then because I figured if I'm going to join the Navy, I'm going to make a career out of it. I'll be a lifer. And I punched some calculator numbers through my mind, and it wasn't where I wanted to be financially. So I said to my roommates, you join the Navy, I'm quitting smoking cigarettes. And so I quit smoking cigarettes. They went off to the Navy. And I picked up a bad habit of smoking some low-grade Mexican. And if you were around me, I would tell you if you only had willpower like me, you could quit smoking cigarettes too. And I also figured out that to do what I needed to do to get into law school, I could no longer hang with the friends I used to hang with. I could no longer go to Sammy's Apex at lunch and have a hamburger steak special with two long neck Busch beers. So I decided to go to school like it was a job. When I was not in class, I was in a cubbyhole in the library. My first quarter was 4-0. I got the dean's permission to carry two extra classes. So I was carrying 21 hours and I had a 4-0. And mind you that the moment I left school, I got in the car, lit one up, stopped at the Shamrock, bought some beer, and drove home to Kingsport. every day, but I was making straight 4-0s. And I decided I was going to drop back to 15 hours of normal load. And I said, you've really done it now because you've taken 21 hours. You know, if you drop back, you're going to have to do it. So I put together 7 straight quarters of 4-0s, drinking and smoking dope every day. Don't know how I did that. During this time, I started dating a young lady who was younger than I was, whose father I had always heard about. And I found out when I started dating her, he was in the program called Alcoholics Anonymous. First time I'd ever heard of Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, I used to take little naps on Friday and Saturday nights over at Charlotte's house. And we were engaged in to get married. And, you know, throughout this thing, her mother would say, you know, Stephen's just like your daddy. He's got a drinking problem. And Charlotte would tell that to me. And no, I wasn't, because her father, George, did kind of strange, crazy things when he was drunk, like go to the country club and fire a pistol through the roof, or take an airplane and fly it underneath the bridge at the local dam, you know, those type of things. So I had started to change my definition of an alcoholic so I wouldn't be an alcoholic. None of you all have ever done that, have you? You know, I originally grew up thinking an alcoholic was a wino or a skid row bum, somebody that had a life dealing with a bad turn. And then I became someone who did kind of crazy things when they were drinking. And that wasn't me. I was a lover. I wasn't a fighter when I got drunk. And so we were engaged to get married, and I'd been accepted to law school, and the invitations had gone out. And it was 19 days of wedding, and I'd finished my last exam, and I was driving from Johnson City to Kingsport, which is about a 15-mile drive, and beautiful afternoon in late May. I had smoked one and had a big cold tall boy between my legs when I pulled into her driveway. She was sitting underneath a tree crying. And I got out and said, Charlotte, what's the matter? She said, I've called the wedding off. And I said, why? She said, well, Mom and I had a talk, and she called it off for me. That was probably my first resentment. And so my parents sent me to Europe, and I spent 6 weeks in Europe out of my gourd. And then I went to law school. And in law school, the first year, I was under the influence every day. Made Dean's List to show everybody I could do it. They wanted me to do law review, and I told them, no, thank you. I was having too much fun. I had the best time of my life in law school, you know. So I coasted the rest of the way through law school because I already had a job when I got out. I didn't see the need to bust ass. I was a pure hedonist. Eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow you may die. And I'd gotten to the point that I knew I needed to be married when I started practicing law, because I didn't like the reputation that some lawyers had in my hometown. My hometown was dry, and they hung out in Johnson City where the university was, in the bars, and they were the little sleazier reputation attorneys. And I didn't want that, because I knew I'd be at the bars looking for female companions if I wasn't married. And if I didn't find a female companion, I knew I would get drunk, which happened most of the time. So I married a young lady I met in law school. I know in hindsight it was to control my drinking. Marriage made in hell from get-go. I knew from the time I got on the honeymoon I'd made the biggest mistake in the world. In law school, she drank and used dope with me. When we got married, I couldn't use dope anymore. And I could not get a divorce from her because you all would know I had made a mistake, that I was not perfect. And I was raised not to make mistakes, to be perfect. So I stayed married to her thinking she would change for 3 years. And I wore alcohol and drugs out. I had my tolerance for alcohol that I had been so proud of all those years went away. And I was getting intoxicated on less amounts of alcohol all the time. Look at my watch. Lisa told me I had 3 hours to speak. So, and I'm talking about my favorite subject, me. You know. I didn't know what was going on. Friends were saying, Stephen, what's the matter? You're loaded. What's the matter with you? And I didn't know. And I found my second cure for alcoholism. My first was being married. The second cure was a magic white powder. And as long as I had that, I could drink all night like I used to be able to drink. And as my wife ended up becoming a judge, and you know, to be married to a judge, you understand a little bit about contempt of court. And I was in contempt of court quite a bit. We went to marriage counselors, and all the marriage counselors wanted to talk about was my drinking. And I knew she'd been going to see them for several months before we got there. And I wanted to talk about what a bitch she was, but they weren't interested in hearing that. And, you know, I couldn't understand why she would be mad at me, because one morning I woke up, and my side of the bed was next to the closet. I get out of bed, and right in front of her closet, just soaking wet. And I said, "What happened?" She said, "You blankety blank blank, you opened the door and pissed on my shoes in the middle of the night." I don't remember it. I'd give anything if I could remember that. I would give anything. You know, but the blackouts were coming off, and whenever we would go out, one of three scenarios. I quit arguing over who was going to drive. I'd give her the keys when we got there. And I'd either remember getting ready to leave the party, getting about halfway to the car, or getting in the car, and the next thing I know, it would be morning. And I would go in the kitchen, and I would see a bottle of scotch and a bottle of bourbon. And I was the scotch drinker, and the scotch had less in it than it did before we went to the party. So I was coming home and drinking and not remembering it. And the counselor had me writing down numbers of drinks. I don't know if you've all had to keep track for a spouse of the number of drinks you're having. And I was not very honest on my tally sheet. As a matter of fact, I had bottles around the house to where I could refill the one drink I was drinking as I walked around the house so she would never know the difference. And every now and then she'd catch me not putting something on there, and she'd put it on there, and it wasn't a pleasant chart to look at. I was involved in an organization, Ducks Unlimited. And the object in Ducks Unlimited is to get everybody as drunk as they can and spend a bunch of money so they can raise money for more baby ducks up in Canada to come down south so we can shoot blank out of them. And you know, we had these organizational meetings, and we'd all sit around and drink, and there was this fellow, Jerry, who didn't drink. And I said, "Jerry, why don't you drink?" And he said, "Well, I'm an alcoholic." I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "I'm an alcoholic. I belong to Alcoholics Anonymous." And that's about all he said about Alcoholics Anonymous. It was the second time I'd heard about Alcoholics Anonymous. He'd gone to the University of South undergraduate school, and he told me a little bit about himself, and I could relate to his experience. And I remember one night asking him if he thought I had a drinking problem. And he said, "I don't know, Stephen. You seem to be able to handle it pretty well. If you decide you do, give me a call." And he moved away to Nashville, Tennessee, and he gave me his phone number. That was in the fall of 1981. In January 1982, one of my good friends, who I had grown up with, a little bit younger than me, and I'd partied with, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, whose mother I knew had been in AA. He was a probation officer over in Virginia, and he got arrested and thrown in the drunk tank for drunk driving. And he started going to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I started avoiding Kevin like the plague. He tried to get me to go to AA. And I just could not comprehend life without alcohol. And he didn't push it. That summer of 1982, because of this magic white powder I had found, I drank what should have been a lethal overdose of scotch. And my judicious wife took me to the hospital. And I took several liters of glucose in a relatively short period of time. But before I got out, I had friends bring some white powder to the hospital. And when I got out in a warm summer afternoon, I sat in the backyard with some Bush beer and some left-handed cigarettes and marveled how wonderful life was, and I had almost died. You know, I was in a downward death spiral. That smell of death was all around me, and I couldn't smell it. Christmas time in 1982, I was going to Delaware hunting with my father-in-law and brother-in-law, And my wife's mom and dad and brother were coming up, and my parents were coming over, and I had run out of that magic white powder. I was at the end of my rope, and I left in the middle of the night, Christmas Eve, to go find my friend who had the magic white powder. And I couldn't find him, and I came home Christmas morning, and my wife was sitting on the front porch crying. And she said, "I want a separation." And I'm a divorce lawyer, and I know what that means. And I said, "Everything will be okay." And my parents and brothers and everybody came over. We had Christmas lunch at my house. And I was going the morning of the 26th to Delaware goose hunting. And I can remember being awakened rather rudely on the morning of December the 26th. And told in very various tirades that she had never been more embarrassed her entire life. I had passed out on the living room couch in front of her mother, father, and brother. And then she and her brother had dragged me down the hall, you know, no farther than from here to Gary, to my bedroom. And they had tried to undress me to put me into bed. And I told them if they didn't leave me alone, I was going to throw up on them. And then she went back out in the living room with her parents, and I hollered for somebody to bring a gun to kill me. And she said, "I want a separation when you get home." So I went to Delaware didn't drink anything on the way up, but boy, I needed a drink bad. And I got up there, and my father and brother-in-law went with my sister-in-law. It was at her house up in Delaware. They went and did some family things, and I got left at the farmhouse with a bunch of little kids. And I wanted to get drunk more than I ever wanted to get drunk in my life. And I started drinking beer. And every beer I would drink, I'd crumple up and hide somewhere around the farm. And no matter how much I drank, I couldn't get drunk. Alcohol had let me down for the first time. The next day, we were at a bar, and we were going to be getting up early the next morning to go goose hunting, and I wanted to get a mild buzz. And with one or two drinks, I got plastered and went into a blackout. The next morning, I was in a goose pit, and it was pretty exciting when the geese come in on you, but I was literally shaking this wooden box that was buried in the ground. Drove back to Tennessee, and it was all I could do, my father and brother-in-law sleeping, all I could do not to let that car turn into an exit to buy some beer. I needed a beer. I needed something to drink awful bad. I got home. This was on December the 29th, 1982. Walked in the house and poured an iced tea-sized glass of scotch and took a big sip of it and said, "What have you decided, honey?" She said, "I want a separation." And I said, "It's because of this." She said, "I don't care." And I poured that out. That's the last drink I've had, December 29, 1982. So, you know, being a good divorce attorney, the next morning I went to bed that night and said, "God help me." I was crying. First time I just said, "God help me." You know, everybody was going to know I was a failure, that I wasn't perfect. I was scared to death. So I go to work the next morning, dictate and file my own divorce complaint, because by God, I'm not going to let her beat me to the courthouse. And about 10 o'clock that morning, I get a call from Jerry. God, this thing's in my way. Get a call from Jerry's daughter. And I thought she still lived in Kingsport. She was in Kingsport visiting, and she was calling to check on her brother, who I was handling the DWI case for. And I said, "Joan, have you got your daddy's phone number?" And she said, "Here it is," because I didn't know what I'd done with Jerry's numbers. And I called him, and I said, "Jerry, this is Steven." He said, "What's going on?" I said, "I got a problem." He said, "What?" I said, "I got a problem with alcohol and drugs. I can't stop, Jerry." And he was in the early stages of MS, and he said, "I can't come up there. Will you come spend New Year's weekend with me?" And I said, "Sure." I later found out he is never in his office past 8 o'clock in the morning, and this was right at 11 o'clock when I called him. My father came in about the time I was making arrangements and said, "We've talked to your brother. We're going to buy you an airplane ticket to Pittsburgh. You can go to Pittsburgh for New Year's weekend and spend it with your brother." And then my brother calls and says, "Come on up here. I got an ounce of that magic powder, and I've got a half a pound of that of wonderful weed from Columbia." And I said, "No, I'm not going to do that." I knew that my car had what we call in Tennessee baldy maypops on them. Tires that the thread was showing on them, and it was January, and I had to go over the Cumberland Plateau, so I knew I needed to get new tires. So I made arrangements with my friend who had the magic powder to pick me up while I took my car, and we went to his house, and I sniffed some powder and I smoked some weed, and I knew, boom, the same as the alcohol. That was on December 30th. That's the last mood-altering substances I have put into my body. And my father had told me, he said, "We'll watch the Gator Bowl tonight and I'll see you don't have more than two drinks." And I was scared shitless because I didn't know how I could do that. And I'm driving home from the tire place and I see a car go by I had never seen before. And that was my friend Kevin, the probation officer, who happened to be in Kingsport driving a brand new car. And I said, "I wonder if he went home." And I call his mother's house and he answers the phone and he comes and spends the evening with me and I go to Nashville the next morning. And my friend Jerry took me to my very first day meeting. December 31st, 82 is my sobriety date, the first day clean and sober. Took me to my very first AA meeting at 10 o'clock in the morning on January 1st at the 202 Club in Nashville. And we got there early and I walked in that room. And there were smiling, happy people there. I had never seen anybody smiling and happy at 10 o'clock in the morning on January the 1st, unless they had already started partying for the day. But nobody had bloodshot eyes. Nobody's speech was slurred. And they shared a little bit with me about themselves, and I told them a little bit about me, and they said the words I had never heard before. They said, "We understand." And I felt at home. The meeting was chaired by an Episcopal priest with his clerical collar on. Father Denson, some of the people from Nashville know who I'm talking about. And the topic was, what's different about today than any other day? January the 1st, New Year's resolution. It's just another 24-hour time period in the life of a recovering alcoholic. And so Jerry made arrangements with my father, who was also my employer, that I needed to go to treatment. So we decided that they got me into treatment in Cumberland Heights. The next day I was going in on the second. And I went to my second AA meeting the night of January the 1st in Franklin, Tennessee. And I remember being in there and why I said it, I don't know. But I asked the lady who was chairing the meeting, I said, "How do you sleep?" Because I hadn't slept in days and I knew I was going into treatment the next day. And I knew I needed to be refreshed so I could learn about the disease of alcoholism and about the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And she looked at me and she says, "Will you make me a promise?" And all of a sudden, every eye in that room is looking at me. And she said it again, "Will you make me a promise?" And everybody's eyes started sticking out even farther. And I don't know if any of you all are people pleasers or things, so I wanted to get them to shut up, and I said, "Yes." She said, "Do you believe in God?" I said, "Well, I believe in something." She said, "Do you, the God you believe in, sleep at night?" And I said, "No." She said, "I want you to promise when you go back to where you're sleeping tonight that before you get into bed, you'll get on your knees and pray to this God that doesn't sleep and tell him that you're going into treatment the next day and you'd like to get some rest. And if he would shut the voices down, you'd deal with them in the morning." And she said, "Will you promise me that?" And I said, "What have I gotten myself into?" I'm thinking. And everybody's looking at me. And, of course, I say, "Yes." I don't know whether I meant it or not at the time. But I go back to where I'm staying, and we watch a little football. And I go to get in bed in a room all by myself and close the door, and it's dark as it can be in there. And I get in bed, and I said, something said, "You promised that lady you'd get on your knees and pray." And I felt like a fool getting on my knees and praying. Nobody's seeing me. Had been on my knees since a little child when I used to say, "Now lay me down to sleep." And I got on my knees and prayed and said, "Hey, God, I know you're awake. I said, I need a good night's rest. Would you please shut the voices down? Stop me from thinking about my problems, and I'll take them back in the morning." And I got into bed. And the next thing I knew, it was the next day. The sheets were as smooth as silk. They weren't those crumpled sheets like a quilt from tossing and turning all night long. Then I go to treatment, and because I was basically detoxed, they just kept me overnight in detox. And they released me the next day and say, "You're going to be going down to this cabin. The men are down there, and they'll already be in session." So I go down there, and I walk in the door. It's group of men sitting with the counselor, and the counselor turns around and looks at me and says, "Oh, you're the lawyer. You can always tell a lawyer, but you can't tell him anything." And that pissed me off. And I thought to myself, I'll show him, I'll listen. And I listened. The next day, there was a lecture on spirituality. The director of Cumberland Heights did it. And he had a podium, and he had a big easy chair over here, and he put a little sign that said, "This seat's reserved for God," in that chair. And he dimmed the lights and had an old record player. Some of y'all may remember those things. And he played three songs: "Precious Memories," "Why Me, Lord," and "The Lord's Prayer" by the Mormon Tabernacle Choir. And during those three songs, I cried warm tears, had warm goosebumps all over my body, and I felt a load lifted off my shoulders. From that moment to today, I have not had a craving for alcohol and drugs. They were removed. There was another lady after that lecture was over. She sat in the room when we were both in there amazed and talked about how wonderful it was. And I was on fire with Alcoholics Anonymous. I wanted to know everything that there was about this disease that I had. And, you know, we had to work five steps, and I went ahead and did six and seven. And, you know, and at the end, when you know, the last Sunday night, the person that's closest to graduating chairs the Sunday night meeting. They let the inmates run a meeting once a week. And it was Super Bowl Sunday. And we lobbied to get the meeting later so we could finish watching the Super Bowl. And needless to say, the inmates don't have any control over stuff like that. And when the bell rang to go to the meeting, everybody walked out that door and slammed that screen door, walking up to the meeting location. And I walked out that door and slammed it too. And as I walked the walkway up to that thing, something came over me and said, "If you weren't an alcoholic and an addict, you wouldn't be here and have these problems. Why are you so damn concerned about being able to watch the Super Bowl? You're right where you need to be." And I chaired the meeting on that night. And, you know, there was a fellow, in, you know, a lot of people in the country music business at Cumberland Heights. And, you know, and the thing I had the hardest to grapple around was it's the first drink that gets you drunk. And there's this guy told me, he said, "Steven, you're standing in the middle of railroad tracks and the train comes along and hits you. What kills you? The engine or caboose?" A light goes off in my head. All those times I had said, if I hadn't had that last drink or that last couple of drinks, this wouldn't have happened. There was this relationship with God was explained to me in there. And it, you know, we had a doctor who would come out there, and he talked about alcoholics being love machines in need of a tune-up. And he used the analogy of a corroded battery terminal. And that all you had to do was take a piece of steel wool and just rub that corroded terminal just a little bit, and that would make the connection. And all I had to do was to reach out, and the connection would be made. My friend Jerry had it lined up to me to be the guy who had sponsored him in Kingsport to be his sponsor, to be my sponsor when I got out. A fellow named Ray D. He's dead now. And I got back to Kingsport and I called Ray and he wanted me to meet him that night. And I was scared to death to go to a meeting in my hometown. I'd been going to meetings in Nashville. I'd stayed in Nashville a couple of days after I got out of Cumberland Heights and was couples of Dickinson in an AA meeting. But I was afraid somebody was going to see me in my hometown. So I went into that meeting, sat down, and when I said I'm an alcoholic, my name is Stephen Todd, I felt at home in Kingsport. That was probably the second most important meeting I went to other than my very first meeting. And Ray had 25 years of sobriety. He was old enough to have been my grandfather. He had a high school education. He had been an area delegate from the state of Tennessee. Tennessee's all one area, Area 64. And we got together, and he said, "What step are you on?" And I said, "Ray, we had to do five. I went ahead and did six and seven. Let's get on with it." He said, "The hell you are. I don't even think you've taken step one or understand what that means." And that pissed me off. I was educated beyond my intelligence. And here was somebody with a high school education telling me that I hadn't done seven and eight, And he said, what do you want me to do for you? I want you to help me not drink. He said, well, I've never done drugs. I said, well, I think they're the same thing, Ray. That's what they told me in treatment. He said, well, I don't know about that, you know. So he and I worked through the steps. And the number one thing was for me to call him every day. So I called him every day, and we went through the steps. And he got me pretty involved in service work. He said, we need people like you in the assemblies here in Tennessee, someone who can speak and someone who has some intelligence. Because if you've ever been to a state assembly, you know what I'm talking about. They're good patience testers, tolerance, those type of things. And I got on a fast track to get in state office. I was on state committees and things. About the time that a sober lawyer I'd met in Nashville, Stafford, asked me to get involved in the creation of the Tennessee Lawyers Concern for Lawyers. And so I decided, you know, maybe if I can help people in my profession who have alcohol and drug problems, I can actually have a farther reaching effect than just within the room confines in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. So I started doing that. And still was heavily immersed in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. The crazy thing about this treatment center I'd gone to, you know, they tell you 90 meetings in 90 days, and they give you an aftercare program. So how many meetings are you going to go to, Stephen? Well, what do you think? I told them, I'm going to go to a meeting every day. They said, well, let's be realistic. You know, something you can manage. I said, well, I'm going to go to a meeting every day. And they said, well, what do you think I ought to put down? They said, put 3 a week. I said, okay. I went to 10 a week. That was the most you could go to in my hometown in 1 week. You know, and I still, even today, after 30 years, I go to 4 or 5 meetings a week. I don't know how many meetings I need to go to, but I'm afraid of going to one too few. You know, but I got involved in this lawyer assistance program stuff, you know, and I've been real heavily involved in that. And I see a disturbing thing with that nowadays. The lawyers have left lawyers assistance programs. In the overwhelming majority of states, the sober lawyers don't seem to support their lawyers' assistance programs. And there's a glaring need for those of us who are sober lawyers to reach out to your local lawyer assistance program and avail yourself and say, I'm here to help lawyers that come into your program. Please let me help. The ABA COLAP is wonderful, but it's gotten awful mental health. You know, so I urge you to reach out to your lawyer assistance program. You know, this business about not being able to have fun, that's what kept me out of the rooms of AA for a while. How was I ever going to have fun again? And I heard a story of a fella who walks into an AA meeting in Texas, up above a saloon, and there's several gentlemen in there, including a Texas Ranger. And this young fella walks into that room, and he's covered with mud, blood, cow dung, and everything else, and bruises all over his body. And they tell him he's got to stop drinking. And he says, you mean I can't have fun anymore? And they said that Texas Ranger jumped up out of his chair. He was about 6'8", and his boots and spurs hit the floor. And he looked down at that young fellow and said, son, just how much more fun do you think you can stand? It takes a well-whooped ass, as we say in East Tennessee, to be desperate enough when you walk in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous to do what was not very softly suggested to me. I was told to take actions I didn't believe in, and told if I took those actions, even if I didn't believe them, things would happen. And I saw things happen. You know, I talked at length with my sponsor, Ray, about my experience there when the desire and craving for alcohol and drugs were removed. And he wanted me to admit that was a burning bush experience. He said, most people don't get those things. Damned, it was good. Next to the last day I was in treatment, that same lecture rolled around. I went to it, I didn't get that same experience, but I felt good. And he said, that's because the first one was a burning bush experience. It was a real powerful experience. And I didn't want to admit that because most people never get one. And I wanted more. I wanted more. I'm greedy. I wanted more of that magic. When I was 30 days sober, I came home from treatment, and my wife, who had filed for divorce, and I wanted to see if maybe I was the problem. She wasn't interested. Thank God she wasn't interested. And I was 30 days sober. I was running late to a noontime AA meeting. And as I came out the back end of my office, I literally knocked a young lady down who was a court reporter who I had made eyes at for the last 2 or 3 years. Prettiest female I had ever seen in my entire life. And put a little note under her window on my business card. I'm in process of divorce. Would like to get together sometime. And that was real foreign to me because I'm a very shy person until I get to know people. And I went to my AA meeting. 2 days later, leaving that noontime AA meeting, as I drove back into town, I was in one lane, she was in the other lane, and we smiled at each other driving back into the heart of downtown Kingsport. As I was trying to find her number, damned if she didn't call me. And I told her that I had just gotten out of a treatment center. I was an alcoholic and drug addict, and I, you know, would like to go out with her. Did that cause her a problem? And she said, and she said no. Some of y'all have met Deborah. And, you know, I felt she was a gift from God to go with my sobriety. And so I ended up getting divorced, ended up dating Deborah full-time, and you know, you're supposed to not do anything in the first year of sobriety. And I think I was 5 months sober, and my Ray had met Deborah and knew Deborah. And I go ask Ray, I said, Ray, I want to get married to Deborah. Is it okay? He said, well, she seems to be pretty good. She goes to meetings with you and all that stuff. She seems to accept it. She says, if you want to do it, it's fine. So we got engaged, and we ended up in June of 83, and we got married in September of 83. She's never seen me take a drink of alcohol or use a drug. We have 2 children, 23 and 25. They've never seen me take a drink or use a drug. And she's never been jealous of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Never at all. Now, there was a period of time, some of you all know, in 2004, when they had meetings the summer of in Atlanta. She felt I was neglecting her, that I was not emotionally available to her, and she asked me to leave the house. I was devastated. Absolutely devastated. And if I was going to leave my house, do you know what I did, what my history was doing? Dictated and filed my own divorce complaint. Thinking, I'll show her. She won't like this, and she'll begging me to come back home. Those were my exact thoughts. I was going to play her bluff. And we stayed separated for a period of time, and I didn't like being separated. I didn't like being alone. I didn't like sleeping alone. And I eventually bought my divorce, and I became very, very single for about 30 days. And she didn't like that. Didn't like it at all. And would call crying on the phone. You're going to meet somebody, and you're going to get married. So we're divorced. But you don't need to hurt them like you've hurt me. And I said, but we're divorced. And she said, let's start a committed dating relationship. So we did that, and we got remarried in July of 2005. So I've got a wedding band that says DLN to WST 91783 and 72005. You know. And best thing that ever happened. And I had taken her for granted. I had. And I almost lost her and everything. You know, she's got a great, she knows me like the back of her hand. And she knows about my ego, about my self-centeredness. And she has dubbed it the Stephen Todd Railroad. And if you know anything about a locomotive, A locomotive, when it leaves the station, starts a chugging. Slowly building up steam as it accelerates down the tracks. And that's the way my ego is. And before, you know, once that train is going, I'm the owner, operator, chief ticket taker, engineer of the Stephen Todd Railroad. And if you're not running on my schedule, I run your ass over. You know. And I'm pounding my head against the wall when that happens. And I realize today that I don't have to pound it too hard before I realize I've got that engine running. And I can decelerate. I can reconnect with God. Because this whole thing's about God anyway. You know, the thing I still have the hardest time explaining to men I work with, you know, is that this is a God program. You know, where it says in our book, lack of power was our dilemma. That the purpose of this book is to find a power greater than yourself. And they say, how the hell is that going to help me recover from alcoholism? I don't know. It just does. Trust me. Believe. And you'll see it too. You know, so often when you hear somebody read the 12th step, they will say, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps. The word is the result. That's a promise. That if you work the 12 steps of this program, you will have a spiritual awakening. Guaranteed. Not possible to have anything else happen. You know, we talk about this toolkit, and we talk about the tools, and some of the meetings earlier this week at the CoLab thing in the mornings, we're talking about the slogans and things, and those are useful tools. And a lot of times we talk about these tools and things, and when somebody comes in, you know, we're picking up tools and we're picking up a screwdriver and trying to use it as a hammer, or picking up a saw and trying to use it as a screwdriver, because we don't know how to use these tools. And, you know, I have found out that one message we don't give newcomers is, these are power tools. They work a hell of a lot better when they're plugged into the Spirit. You know, that's what it's all about. That's what it's all about. You know, I heard a story, a lot of y'all probably heard this one, about this alcoholic who passed away. And when he got up to the gates, yes, St. Peter said, we were afraid we weren't going to get you. And he said, well, wonder what was hell like? What was hell like? And he said, we'll show you. And he takes him down there, and he's down there, and he focuses on the room. And the more he focuses, he realizes there's this gigantic banquet table with the finest foods and crystals and everything. And there are all these people sitting in fine gowns and clothes and everything around this table. And they're just miserable-looking frowns that had hung down. And he looks closer, and he says, why are these people so unhappy? And Sam says, look closer. And they've got six-foot arms that are spoons and forks. And he says, wow, they're miserable. You know, and St. Peter says, come on, let's go. And they get up to heaven, and he gets up there, and he realizes he's in a room and starts focusing. And he sees the very same scene he saw down in hell. Here's a room full of people with six-foot arms that are spoons and forks. And they're smiling and happy and having a good time, and they're feeding each other. That's what Alcoholics Anonymous is. That's what this program has given me. And that's what this program can give you if you're willing to reach out. If you're willing to step into the sunlight of the Spirit. To let go, to let God. That's what it's all about. You know, I know today that there are a lot of times when the seas of life are very rough. And if you've heard Clancy talk, you know about his invisible boat. They've got a couple of people like Ted sitting in it, you know, and you know, they come by to get you, and you know, and you just see nothing there, and there's these old codgers in there saying, come on, get in here with us, you know. And once you get in and you start to row this invisible boat, the boat materializes. And I know that I need to be centered in the middle of that boat. I don't need to be up on the gunwales, sitting on the side of the boat, because when the seas of life and the storms of life get rough, I don't want to fall over the side. I need to be grounded and centered in the middle of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I hear individuals all the time say, I don't know if you could stay sober working my program. I guarantee you that I can stay sober working the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. This is one program for all of us that's all encompassing. All we have to do is to work it. We need to work it with somebody else. It's a we program. A little saying, you alone can do it, but you can't do it alone. And that goes against everything you first hear, that willpower alone is not sufficient. You've got to have some willpower to get sober. But willpower alone won't cut it for you. But I really, really appreciate the opportunity to speak here tonight. You know, I don't know if I've said anything to help anybody or not. I've been told that the nature of a good talk is to comfort the disturbed and disturb the comfortable. You know, I look out in this room and there's a lot of people with a lot more sobriety than I have here. I'm not used to speaking to people with this much sobriety. You know, I guess in 30 years I've told my story 100 and some times, and I was more nervous today because you're my esteemed colleagues, some of my heroes in this room, the first sober lawyers I got to know. And I'm honored to have been here tonight. I want you all to come experience some Southern hospitality next year in Nashville, Tennessee. We're going to have a heck of a conference there. Boots, Scoot, and Boogie, we maybe do some line dancing. If you got cowboy boots, bring them. If you don't, spend some money in Nashville and help the state of Tennessee. They need the tax money. And I always, when I talk, I always close the same way. A little poem. Here's to love. There's the wonderful love of a beautiful maid, the love of a staunch true man. There's the love of a baby unafraid. These have existed since time began. But the most wonderful love, the love of all loves, the love that outshines every other, is that infinite, tender, compassionate love of one alcoholic for another. Thank you.